Welcome to The Conversation. I'm Beth Ann Kozlovich. The big question over rail, what happened to all the money, may soon have more answers. This week, the Honolulu City Council approved a resolution to again audit the project. The audit will go beyond last year's report of operations expenses that drew scathing comments from then-HART CEO Dan Grabauskas, fired soon afterward. Council member Trevor Ozawa introduced the resolution. He joins us in our studio now. Thanks for coming in.
You're welcome. Thanks for having me.
When people hear about an audit, they have different ideas about what that means, and they also have a different idea of what this term forensic audit means. We've heard from John Henry Felix that he would like to see a forensic audit done. How do you explain that to people in a way that makes it more accessible to know what that would entail versus what it is that you propose?
Well, the resolution that I proposed here calls for the city auditor to conduct not only a follow-up audit of the 2016 audit, but this audit is also different in that I want the auditor to now focus on the capital construction budget. That audit would look at a budget of approximately $8.5 billion in total, of which several billion has already been expended. The previous audit really focused on about $18 million in operational expenditures. This audit would also be, you know, the first time that, as I mentioned, that the city would be looking at work completed on the construction side of the house and evaluate efficiency and inefficiency of the project from that perspective. That's where a bulk of our money is, and that's where the public wants to see. Depending what money is provided from GET, what would be the best use of that money if it goes beyond Middle Street? I think that this audit is going to allow us to get back on track. This audit will allow the auditor to do what he is charged to do in the charter, which is to conduct a performance audit.
And he said that he can't do a quote-unquote forensic audit. But we need to get into that, what that would mean in terms of what it is that you're suggesting be done. And also, how does that perhaps not give people the kind of information that they want to know about where this thing went wrong or what kind of malfeasance there might have been?
Right. So a forensic audit, it's an examination and evaluation of a typically a firm or an institution's, financial information for use in evidence for court, really. It's a litigation tool, typically. And in this case, if John Henry Felix, a HART board member, would like to conduct one, by all means, it's well within their means to go ahead and move forward with that on the HART board, and I fully support those HART board members in making that action happen. And I do support the forensic audit if that's what they want to decide on. From the city council side, we have a city auditor that is only authorized by charter to perform two types of audits, a performance audit or a financial audit, not forensic. So in this case, using the authority that we have at the city council and using what the city auditor's capabilities are, I'm calling on us to conduct this performance audit to really look at the processes of where the inefficiencies are, both with the construction, with the entirety of the construction side of the project, which is the $8.5 billion roughly of costs. So you look at that. We want to look at whether or not subcontractors are doing their job appropriately and lawfully within the scope of the work. How many change orders have there been? Has that drastically increased the costs? Have the generals been doing their job? Are they performing pursuant to the contracts that they've been assigned? Is the payment processing going according to plan? Are we losing money by inefficiencies in the process there? Has HART failed to plan appropriately from the very beginning? And I think what we will probably find is that that's a large part of it. And we heard some of that.
Some of that came out last year.
Well, not only last year, last week, this week at Radford High School, when the legislature had a briefing. You know, I spoke with a senator, and the senator noted that he was quite surprised that that some of these stations were just poorly put out to bid, and that some things weren't thought through. For example, no bathrooms at some of these stations, exposed walkway for 10 minutes going to the nearest terminal at the airport station. Things like that lead to inefficiencies, because at a certain point, we are going to have to address the inefficiencies and inadequacies of the stations, of the guideway, et cetera, and that adds up. And so, quite frankly, I think what we're going to find in this performance audit, it's my first kind of gut reaction, is we grossly underestimated the cost of the project from the very beginning. We have seen that the planning for this has been ill-conceived in a lot of ways, not perhaps on purpose, but because of the fact that we have inexperienced people that haven't worked on a project of this magnitude.
And here we are with a change now happening with HART leadership, and we've had almost a year of an interim director. How forthcoming do you expect current HART leadership to be, and same with the incoming HART leadership as we move forward?
Well, the interim executive directors, both Formby and Murthy, have been very willing to work with anybody. They've been very transparent, and it's been a marked difference from the former executive director, Grabowskis, who's no longer here. And part of the reason why he's not here is because of the last audit that we ordered, which raised a lot of red flags.
Right, and we don't have to go down that path again because of short of time here, but I really want to look at where you expect this to go as we move into the future. Next week we're supposed to have, or not next week, but the week after that, a special session. All this, so much of it at least, rests with the legislature and how they expect this to go forward. How do you expect that this audit is going to help them to make that determination, being that we have this very short time frame between when we expect to have any answers back and when the ledge will be meeting?
Yeah, this audit is not going to be able to provide them with the legislature the answers that they need for this upcoming special session, because this audit will take at least a year or so to complete.
Which is to say that people shouldn't be relying on this idea in some way to see what may happen next week. Does that sort of put the shoe on the wrong foot?
No, it's just very timely, though, that the legislature understand that we at the city council are fully engaged with being a partner in this, to understand that we're not wasting money in any sort of way, that we are keeping a very close eye on how the money is spent. And we do have skin in this game. Our skin is making sure that the process is followed correctly, lawfully, and most efficiently as possible, because the tax dollars are not just state tax dollars. They're not just city tax dollars. They're residents' tax dollars. And that, you know, it doesn't matter whether you're city, state, or federal level. It's tax dollars that's coming out of a resident's pocket. So when we're talking about what's going on at the ledge maybe next week or the week after, you need to remember that these are different issues. The ledge is really looking at how much more, if any, funding sources they're going to give us beyond 2027.
Right, but a lot of that is based on a lot of charges of waste and many of the things that we've just talked about in this conversation.
I think so. I think it also has to do with the fact that not only waste, I think increased costs not associated with waste.
But ill-conceived ideas, things that weren't planned appropriately, all of that as those things arose became reasons for additional monies necessary to be able to fix them.
Right. I think this upcoming session, though, is imperative for the federal government, the FTA, to understand where we are at currently, because we've already missed one deadline, and now they've set a second deadline, September 15th. So this is going to be something for them to understand where we are at with us as a state on this project. Are we, you know, going to be complying with the FFGA? Now, with regard to that, it's not a bad time to also consider whether or not we want to continue to remain partners with the FTA and the federal government beyond Middle Street, or if there's any room for negotiation to part ways.
I'm afraid we're going to have to leave it there in the interest of time, but I thank you for coming in.
Thank you.
Good to talk to you.
Thank you.
Trevor Ozawa represents East Honolulu on the City Council. That includes Hawaiʻi Kai, Ainahaina, Diamond Head, and portions of Kaimuki.
Journalists who follow a story closely, as Wayne Yoshioka has with the Honolulu Rail Project, absorb a wealth of detail beyond what they can report, and in the wake of a busy week for rail, including new charges of lax internal oversight, we want to ask Wayne for a progress report. He's with us in our studio. Hi, Wayne. Thanks for coming in.
Good morning, Chris. Yeah, we had two really big meetings this week to set the stage for the special session of the legislature on August 28th. The first was an eight-hour marathon session with a joint legislative public information briefing.
And, Wayne, I wanted to ask you about that because, hovering behind all this as Hart goes to the legislature for funding is what if they don't get it, right? And that seemed to me something that has emerged more strongly in the past week than it has before. Does it seem that way to you?
No, I think they always play this game of chicken where they get entrenched in their positions and they say, look, it's the legislature that really needs to do this funding mechanism. It's not Hart. It's not the city and county of Honolulu. It's the legislature. And that really puts them in a spot.
Yeah.
That really puts them in a precarious place where, you know, they've got to come and they've got to be the bad people that say, okay, city and county of Honolulu, you can use this source of funding to fund your $8.2 billion rail transit project.
Right.
So that's the way it is. And I think this past Monday, Senator Donna Mercado Kim really said it to the Hart Interim Executive Director and CEO, Krishnaiya Murthy, and this is what she said.
You guys are so arrogant that you're thinking we're going to give you the whole amount and you're not planning on any alternative in the event it doesn't happen.
We understand your frustration. We are trying our best.
Obviously, it's not Hart's Kuleana to do the funding mechanism. It's the legislature, and therein lies the frustration, I think.
I got the impression, is this an accurate impression, that past a certain point there is no plan CRD, you know, the possibility still exists for it all to come unglued. Is that accurate?
Correct. If they don't come up with something that they can agree on, both the House and the Senate, we stand at the point where there's no funding. The Federal Transit Administration has set a September 15th deadline for a new financial plan. So here we are. We're headed down this road, and it's a game of chicken.
Well, I mean, there's an abyss at the end of this road, right? And with that deadline coming up soon, I mean, what realistic hopes do we have of getting this all worked out?
There is no plan B. And it's all in the legislature's lap. And I think that was something that the Hart Vice Chair, Terrence Lee, said.
Yeah.
And this is what he said.
If we don't get additional funding from the legislature, then it's likely the alternative options that we would pursue would be unacceptable to the FTA. We would lose the $1.55 billion. And then with the remaining money that we have just from the GET surcharge, what can we accomplish? And I think the legislature would like to know that.
And that was the other meeting with the Honolulu Authority for Rapid Transportation. And they had their board of directors meeting, and they basically came out and said, you know, it's the general excise tax surcharge or nothing. I mean, this is it. We're putting all of our eggs in one basket.
If it's nothing, Wayne, what have we got? A partially completed relic that just kind of sits there and only goes to, I mean, how far along are we?
I don't think anyone's thought that through. I think they're relying on the legislature to come through at the 12th hour, as they always do.
Yeah.
But it could fall apart because basically the Senate is saying, we don't like the transit accommodations tax. It's not a very steady stream of funding, and we don't want to use that. And we have the travel industry that came out and said, no, don't take our money.
You know, when you talk about a project of this magnitude and something that's a very real possibility, and you say you don't think anyone's thought that through, that kind of gives one pause, doesn't it?
Yes, especially when they don't have a plan B. They don't have an alternate source of funding. This is all, I mean, it's like going to Las Vegas and having one throw at the dice.
Yeah.
I mean, that's what it amounts to. And it's a game of chicken right now between the city and county of Honolulu and the state legislature.
With a fairly large potential embarrassment for the city, the state, pretty much everyone concerned, yeah?
And I don't think this is the end of it, because they're allotting $1.4 billion to complete the segment from Middle Street to Ala Moana Center.
Right.
And $1.4 billion is going to go up like that in that length of time. It's 4.2 miles and 8 stations.
So that 1.4 is going to go the way of every other estimate we've heard, which is to say triple or beyond, right?
I'm sorry to say that's what there are a lot of people that feel that way.
Well, there are some obstacles, you know, unintended, unforeseen obstacles, which almost always happen in a massive public works project.
That's right. And it, you know, it's, what is that saying? An elephant is a mouse drawn to government specifications. It's only going to grow.
Well, I guess we could laugh in the short term, but this is something we're going to want to keep a lot
of. It's going to be a tragedy, yes.
Thanks very much, Wayne.
Thank you.
Wayne Yoshioka is HPR's political reporter, and you can find full versions of his stories on our website, hawaiipublicradio.org. This is The Conversation on statewide member-supported Hawaii Public Radio. Coming up in the show, a risk of unintended consequences in a proposed bill to combat sex trafficking. But first, your quiz.
On Wednesday, the world celebrated the life and death of the beloved king of rock and roll. Elvis Presley died on August 16, 1977, at the age of 42 at his home, Graceland, in Memphis, Tennessee. Today, we're remembering happier days with the king. In 1963, on a Seattle, Washington film set, Elvis charmed 6.5-year-old Vicky Chiu during a scene that she just couldn't get right. He took the young actress to dinner, and they started fresh the next day. Chiu stole the scene with her big saucer eyes, hearty appetite, and sweetly scheming ways. She went on to become Hawaii's first lady from 1994 to 2002 through her marriage to Ben Cayetano, Hawaii's fifth governor. The king was naturally a huge attraction to the girls of Seattle. Whether he left the set, whenever he left the set, there was a trail of swooning women stepping on feet, harried policemen that followed. For today's backyard quiz, can you tell us the name of the film that sparked Vicky Tiu's young acting career and showcased Presley's charm with women of all ages? You can call us at 941-3689 or 877-941-3689 if you know the answer. And the first one to get it right gets the backyard quiz tote bag that tells everybody you did.
Support for The Conversation comes from the HPR Local Talk Show Fund, which helps Hawaii Public Radio sustain and grow its locally produced talk shows. Mahalo to contributors, locations, Noheia Gallery, and Straub Medical Center.
Yesterday on Town Square, I sat down with New School Superintendent Christina Kishimoto. She's got the governor's support, but as Civil Beat reporter Suvon Lee finds, the governor says he had no hand in her selection. Suvon Lee joins us now. Hi there.
Hi, Beth Ann. Good to be here.
So why would this even be an issue that the governor might, or as he says, didn't have a hand in her selection?
Well, as we know, the governor appoints members of the Board of Education, and the Board of Education is the one that's in charge of finding and hiring the new superintendent. When we talk about the selection process that unfolded late last year and this year, people talk about how that process developed. I think that now that a new superintendent's in place, the administration certainly wants to look forward rather than dwelling on what happened back then.
So why talk about it?
That's interesting. I think that its process is something that's on the minds of Hawaiians here. However, as the governor told us in an extensive interview, he's looking at what the new superintendent's going to do, and he's very excited about how she's already approaching her job.
And what did he say specifically that makes him more excited about her choice than her predecessor?
Well, he talked a lot about how Dr. Kishimoto, the new superintendent, is visiting the schools. She's engaging with teachers and principals. She's visiting classrooms. He heaped a lot of praise on her strategy as far as going out there and meeting people. He talked about her showing up unannounced at football games, for instance, even on weekends, engaging with the community, learning what their needs and concerns are, and he was quite praiseworthy of that.
And what about some of her ideas in which she hopes to engage beyond just showing up at social engagements?
Well, we also spoke with Christina Kishimoto earlier this month when she began her job. And one of her things is really to kind of take a deep dive, as she said, as far as English language learning instruction and special education inclusion goes in the schools, things that really do matter to a lot of parents, particularly given the track record that the Hawaii Department of Education has when it comes to certain underserved communities and student populations. So I think that he's very encouraged by what she's going to be doing when it comes to those areas.
We talked with her yesterday and she mentioned that too. Also engaging teachers in a different way than perhaps they have in past. What did you hear from the governor about her relationship with teachers? Certainly he's had a good relationship with HSTA that we've seen in a very non-contentious, very easy and smooth situation with renewing contracts.
That's right. I think that the teachers are really a critical element here. Clearly, they're the ones who are in the classroom every day. They're the ones who are seeing firsthand what's working and what's not working for students. So it appears to me that the new superintendent is really wanting to engage and hear what programs that they're applying in their own schools that might work across the state. The governor even told me yesterday about such things such as early college credit learning pathways in which high school students might start learning or accruing college credit at the high school level. He really wants to see those kinds of programs that are successful and are working in certain communities replicated across the state. So we'll see what happens this year.
Well, and she's got a 3-year contract, so we'll see how that plays out over its term. And thanks so very much for today's reality check.
Thanks, Beth Ann.
Every day we bring you a reality check from Civil Beat, today featuring education reporter Suvon Lee. And this being a Friday, we're going to check in with News Director Bill Dorman about what's coming up for the coming week in our news department. And clearly there's a buzz on medical marijuana.
Bit of
I'm
a buzz.
Sorry about that.
I wrote it. Thanks for using it. Aloha, Beth Ann. You know, it's hard to believe it's been 15 months now since those 8 medical marijuana licenses were announced. 15 months. For a long time, you know, there was a focus on getting the labs up, getting them certified and approved, then getting the dispensaries themselves up and running. So now that we're seeing more of them come online, we're also seeing growing pains. Yes, it's true. But
and growing costs.
Growing costs, yeah, and distribution pains and costs as well, and consumer costs. A lot of folks have been surprised by the time this comes out to the end patients and the users in terms of how much this is, and folks running into finance problems themselves on this. So there are a wide range of sort of issues out there. Lawmakers, of course, going to be taking a look at this before the next session, not the special session on rail, of course, but the next regular session. So now is the time to take a closer look at maybe what might be needed in fine-tuning some of this legislation. So an oversight committee is going to be looking at this later this week. Kuvehi Hiraishi is going to be listening in on that. Later in the week, this is interesting too, the Hawaii Venture Capital Association having a roundtable on this. Wayne Yoshioka is going to be covering that. But it's interesting, you know, HCVA has had sessions on this topic going back to 2015.
But as we've seen clearly in the last 15 months, and as you note, so many add-ons that keep changing the picture
exactly. For
both the provider and for those who need to be able to purchase medical marijuana. And where this goes from here, well, that's the big question.
It's a moving picture.
Now, while we're talking about add-ons, what about a lot of what we've seen with renewable energy growth?
So, again, this is another growth story across the islands. Kauai, some very interesting things happening with batteries on massive utility scales and involving some big names, Tesla, SolarCity, AES, and we'll get an update on that, some further information. Scott Jarman up on Kauai is going to be telling us about that.
And 2 seconds, what's going on with arts and culture?
No, he's got a huge retrospective, Masami Teraoka. More on that this coming week.
All right. Thanks, Bill. Some of the things coming out of HPR's news department next week. Also on a Friday, you know that one of the things we do is to dip into our email bag and to take a look at what we hear from our talkback line. And this week we heard this.
Hi, this is Gary Grocious. I'm calling you from Hawaii. I was listening to the segment where Chris Vanderhook was talking to the gentleman from Guam in respect to, God forbid, nuclear attack. And advice from the civil defense to basically duck and cover. The two gentlemen kind of poo-hooed that as you're going to be gone anyway. But the truth of the matter is you're not necessarily going to be gone. If you're far enough away, the concussion blast may knock your windows out. It may tear your roof off. But if you're under the table, you might survive. And if the wind's blowing away from you, you might not even fall out either. And then you might be able to do something about it, help somebody else. But the attitude that, just forget it, you know, is not the right attitude. And I feel that the gentlemen were expounding that a little bit. And I just wanted to say, hey, there's some validity to trying to protect yourself.
After last week's interview on proposed restrictions to legal immigration, Ruth Oparesa Almarosa wrote this on Facebook. Immigrants have a big contribution to our community, state, and country. They work hard to earn a living for their family. They're dedicated, hardworking immigrants, and we should be grateful for what they do and deserve to be respected.
Thanks for all the feedback. You know you can always email us at talkback@hawaiipublicradio.org. Reach out via social media on Facebook or Twitter, or just call the Talkback line at 792-8217.
Support for today's programming comes from Bishop Museum. The original exhibit, Hulia Ano, Inspired Patterns, explores Hawaiian aesthetic traditions by examining the ano, or nature, of objects in pattern, shape, and form. Open through October 16th.
The Internet has had so many unintended, unanticipated consequences, some of them operating in the service of crime. In one troubling example, online tools are widely used by sex traffickers, and the Stop Enabling Sex Traffickers Act of 2017, a bill introduced in the U.S. Senate last week, is designed to attack the service providers the traffickers use. Could this be a well-intentioned effort that's likely to have unintended consequences of its own? Mike Godwin, a senior fellow at the R Street Institute in Washington, D.C., think so, and we talk to.
Everybody agrees that sex trafficking is bad, and we want it to be punished, and we want people to be prosecuted for doing it. Nobody disagrees about that. The question is, what's the strategy to reduce sex trafficking or to address the crime? And some lawmakers think that maybe what you ought to do is hold internet companies responsible in some way, or make it easier to sue or prosecute internet companies if criminals, including sex traffickers, use the internet to commit their crimes.
Mm-hmm.
The difficulty here is that we wanted to create an environment 20 years ago when we passed laws that internet forums, like being able to talk to each other on Facebook, don't automatically make Facebook legally liable, and your email company is not legally responsible for what you say, just as your phone company is not responsible for what you say on the phone. That seems to have worked out pretty well, but some lawmakers maybe think the internet is uniquely dangerous, and they want to take away a protection that we put in place more than 20 years ago.
And what you're saying is that it's a communications avenue like several others, yeah?
That's right. It's absolutely right. People committed crimes before the internet, as some of us are old enough to remember. And people would use tools like the public telephone network, or they would use the mails, to talk to each other and to do things that ultimately they use in criminal ways. But we don't hold the post office responsible for everything that anyone uses the mail for. And we don't hold FedEx responsible for things that people send through FedEx.
Mm-hmm.
And the same principle has been applied by law through an act that was passed in 1996.
The
Communications Decency Act. It was part of the big Telecom Act of 1996. And so what you're seeing here is some members of Congress are saying we ought to open that protection up again, and we're going to do it for sex traffickers, but we're also going to make it easier for internet companies to be sued in the states or prosecuted in the states, and we're going to make it harder for new internet companies to start, so they have to assume the risk that they may be prosecuted just for having a mail service or a communication service that other people use.
It begins to sound, from the way you describe it, this bill sounds a little bit like it's throwing the baby out with the bathwater, just going way too far to address an individual problem, creating a bunch of other problems as it does so.
I think that's absolutely right. You put your finger on it, throwing the baby out with the bathwater, because what's happening is that we know, everybody I think knows, that over the last couple of decades, the internet has fueled a lot of economic growth for Americans. The internet has fueled a lot of public engagement for Americans. And the ability to find information and the ability to talk to one another, no matter how far away you are from other people, that's been very exciting and very liberating for people. And that's a huge benefit.
Mm-hmm.
And it's really important. What I think we're seeing is that some members of Congress, and by no means all, are looking at the internet as a place where there's perhaps a special danger or a special unfairness that that companies like Facebook can't be easily prosecuted or sued for things people do on their services. And it really would throw the baby out with the bathwater, because if you are a big, already successful company like Facebook, you may be able to adapt to changes in the law to some extent. At least, maybe you'll be less successful, but you maybe could do it because you're very rich. But in this country, we believe that we like to say that the playing field is level enough that a new Facebook could come along or a new Google could come along, a startup in people's garages or, basements. And what we do is, if we impose legal liability on everybody who creates the next version of the internet or the next version of Facebook or the next version of the telephone, then they won't do it.
Well, Mike, is there a parallel? Just a few days ago, GoDaddy took down a neo-Nazi website that it had been inadvertently hosting, is what it sounded like. Is there a parallel to that?
Well, this is a really great question, because that particular issue has caused a lot of people in the law schools and in the legal community to ask whether GoDaddy or other services like Google that host websites need to be policing for bad content or not. And they could. GoDaddy certainly can do a certain amount of policing, and other services could, but it should be noted that GoDaddy did this without the change in the law that some members of Congress are seeking. GoDaddy just did it as a private entity exercising its right to choose who to do business with. But if Congress had its way, if Congress or some members of Congress passed this law, then there may be either legal obligations on GoDaddy and every other company to take down content, all sorts of content, depending on whether it's either criminal or just assumed to be criminal or used by criminals. And they may also be at legal risk. They may have to face state lawsuits from state attorneys general, and they may have to face a bunch of private lawsuits that under current law they're immune from. And once again, that current law is really just to put the Internet in the same place that we traditionally have held telephone services and mail services and package delivery services, not responsible for how people use them.
So the current legal structure, what you're saying, Mike, should be enough?
Well, we think so. It's worth noting, we think that the current legal structure, which is usually called, in shorthand, Section 230, the current legal structure has actually been pretty well tested by time. We've had it for more than 20 years. We feel that the Internet has mostly provided a large number of public benefits, both economic and democratic benefits, and we're happy about that. And virtually everyone who works on these issues, on policy and legal issues about the Internet, thinks that Section 230 was central to how we got the lively, robust Internet that we got today. And so we don't want to mess with it.
Mike Godwin is a fellow at the R Street Institute. His piece, which runs in the current online edition of Slate, argues that the Stop Enabling Sex Traffickers Act of 2017 would undermine aspects of Internet freedom in the U.S. that have been critical to their economic success. Earlier in the show, we paid tribute to rock and roll king Elvis Presley, who spent a portion of his career lounging on Hawaii beaches. Today, we took a look at one of his movies that was filmed on location at the Seattle World Fair. Elvis played Mike, a crop duster pilot who found himself in a dilemma after his partner and friend Danny gambled away the money Mike had set aside to pay their debts. The film hit theaters on April 3, 1963, brought in $2.5 million, a large amount for the time. It featured little Sue Lynn, played by Vicky Tew, who was a young girl befriended by Mike. Tew later grew up to be the First Lady of Hawaii when she married Hawaii Governor Ben Cayetano. The name of that film was It Happened at the World's Fair. Nobody got that today, but that's today's quiz. If you've got a quiz, you can send it to talkback@hawaiipublicradio.org.
What's the best way to improve a city? Some people would start with a look at the streets, and not just the cars. That's the idea behind Complete Streets, a program that's been underway for some time around the state. My colleague Bill Dorman spoke with Mike Packard, the person who's leading Complete Streets in Honolulu.
Complete Streets is a different way of looking at cities. It's an approach that aims to create a comprehensive, integrated network of streets that are safe and convenient for all people, whether traveling by foot, bicycle, transit, or automobile, and regardless of age or ability. In 2009, the state passed a law requiring all counties in Hawaii to adopt a complete streets policy. The city and county of Honolulu finalized its complete streets design manual last fall and hired an administrator, Mike Packard, who's been good enough to join us on the conversation to give us an update on how things are going. Aloha, Mike, and thanks for coming in.
Aloha.
So, how are things going?
I think we're off to a great start, and really, this is not a program that's starting from new. Complete Streets is something that's always been integrated in a part of Honolulu and the way we do design. It's just become mandated now. Like anything, change is hard. However, the realization of where we need to be as a city and providing for our residents is there. And I think people understand that safety is really the key goal. And so, you know, I'd say we're doing quite well.
So you, among other things, are a professional traffic operations engineer. When you look at Honolulu traffic, what do you see from a planning perspective overall, big picture?
Well, you kind of hit on two separate things there. The one being the traffic operations engineer, that goes back to a prior life of mine, and really the way traffic engineers were trained, and that's understanding the nuances of movement of vehicles and intricacies of making sure that delay is minimized, and really we can provide for the largest amounts of capacity with the highest safety. How that plays into where I am today is I understand the traffic, and I understand why we are where we are. And much of that goes beyond the traffic, but to the land use planning and some of the sprawl that we've had. And cities across the U.S. have really dealt with. And when you have limited space, it's much easier to spread out than it is to go up. And so as we've gotten that sprawl and limited places to build roads between the mountain and the ocean, there's really limited ability for us to move the people that we've put out so far. So, you know, when it comes to dealing with our traffic situation, you know, really providing those sustainable alternative options is the solution to get us where we are going and where we need to go to be a more sustainable island.
Those constituencies, though, can be pretty different in terms of folks behind the wheel and folks on bikes and all of that. I mean, it's and also walking around in terms of the pedestrian side of trying to balance those without sort of giving too much weight to one of the groups. How do you find yourself doing that?
Well, and that's really the million-dollar question. And when we talk about complete streets, you know, there is no cookie-cutter way that we look at these streets. Not every street is going to have the same needs for treatments. Not every street really has the demand or necessity for various ones. So, you know, a protected bike lane like we have on King Street is not appropriate or necessary on a neighborhood street where people should be traveling in the 20-mile-per-hour range, and sharing the road with a vehicle should be rather a low-stress type of use. When we look at the bikeway design, you know, for the majority of time here, when you think of cyclists, you're thinking of the spandex-clad or the reckless crazies driving down the road. And the reality is that those cyclists, they would be riding their bike regardless of the infrastructure we put in. National studies have shown that, you know, 60% of people are interested but concerned. So if we have that high a number of the population that would actually ride a bicycle, choose to ride a bicycle as opposed to needing to take their car, if we could design facilities that accommodated that 60%, we could quite easily alleviate some of those traffic demands. That doesn't mean that people from Ewa or Kapolei or Hawaii Kai are going to be taking their bikes in from that line. We're not looking at it from that perspective. Mm-hmm. When it comes to transit, rail, bus, it's those last mile connections. If you take your bike to the rail station or to a bus, you put it on the bus or the rail, you take it into where you need to go, you make that last mile connection. That's where really the bike infrastructure can help support that.
You know, on a very pragmatic level, what's the deal in terms of bikes on sidewalks, though, and pedestrians? That's a real issue in a lot of places.
It's an absolute issue, and it's one we hear about every meeting and largely when we go to the pedestrian advocate groups. Mm-hmm. You know, that's one of their biggest concerns, and, you know, something that we need to understand is this is not a pedestrian versus bicycle situation. What it comes down to is insufficient facilities for bicyclists to be able to make the choice to ride in the road or on the bike path that, or lane that exists there. So I really take that as my responsibility to make those cyclists that are choosing to ride on the sidewalk, provide them an alternative, an equal alternative in the road where they would choose to ride there and not conflict with pedestrians. Because realistically, in our business districts, in our downtown, Waikiki, Chinatown, those are areas where we have such a high volume of pedestrians on the sidewalk.
It's dangerous and it happens right
on. It absolutely is.
As well. Let me move to one other area. The bulb outs, these structures, I understand, designed to act as curb extensions. They popped up in Chinatown last month. They've caused a lot of confusion. A couple of weeks ago, City Council Committee approved a resolution urging the city to immediately remove them and before taking any further traffic calming measures to consult with business and residents to consider the impacts. Number one, I guess, what comes with this and or what comes next with this? And number two, lessons learned on that score?
Yeah, absolutely. It's a realization that communication should have been better between us, the elected representatives, in addition to those merchants who we have heard, are most concerned and feeling the brunt of this. It's something that going forward we will ensure that our communication is better. But it really comes back to the intent of the bulb outs and what they're there to demonstrate. And it's a product of Complete Streets. It's prefacing where we are trying to go, and that's the extension of the sidewalk.
But it's also, as you know, somebody, I spent a lot of time downtown, and when those popped up, it was, oof, what are these? And you can't drive down Mauna Kea, I can't pop over and pop in the Lay Shop, and a lot of people were just confused in terms of what is the deal.
Yeah, and what you said is exactly what the deal was. It's unfortunate, but many of those places where people were popping over and popping in, those were illegal parking, illegal loading, illegal stopping places, and they're illegal for a reason, and that's because they put pedestrians at jeopardy. Having people stop on the crosswalk or in an area that could potentially block line of sight, that's a pedestrian safety hazard. And then having the unfortunate title of worst or highest number of pedestrian elderly deaths in the country, that's something that Honolulu really needs to take a step and look at so we can rectify that situation. And it's not about turning a blind eye to the illegal activities that have been going on. It's making sure that we're accommodating all users. That includes the merchants. We need to make sure that we are providing the appropriate loading and stopping and pickup places. So it's working with them and working with the entirety of the community, because people are pulling over because they don't have a safe or alternative place to pull over. So maybe we take some of those parking stalls and turn them into short-term loading zones.
Work in progress, and we look forward to checking back in with you.
Absolutely.
On that work in progress. Mike Packard, heads of Complete Streets Program of the City and County of Honolulu. Mike, thanks for coming in.
Thanks so much.
Support for The Conversation comes from the HPR Local Talk Show Fund, which helps Hawaii Public Radio sustain and grow its locally produced talk shows. Mahalo to contributors Inter Island Solar Supply, Kaiser Permanente, and Hastings and Pleadwell, a communication company.
There are a lot of different activities going on throughout the state, and Morning Edition host Derek Malama joins us at this point in our show every day to look at events going on in our community that might be a little under the radar. Today we're thinking about, among other things, furniture.
Yes. If you're thinking about, say, buying a coffee table, you can head to this Buddhist temple on Maui tomorrow. It's the Montokuji Soto Zen Mission in Pa'ia. The temple's having a sale of new and used furniture and plants, too. And the sale is from 7 to 11 a.m. tomorrow. The mission's located at 253 Hana Highway in Pa'ia on Maui.
And then when you've loaded up the car, you could take a cruise down the Hana Highway.
Oh, yeah.
That'll pretty much fill up your day.
Makes for a beautiful day.
It is. Mm-hmm. And the AARP of Kauai is holding a free workshop on your our everybody's financial future.
Yes, right? I always think about this. It's never too late to start planning for it. Topics include investing with confidence and managing your money in the modern world. A certified financial planner will teach this class from 1 to 4 p.m. tomorrow in the Lihue Public Library. Register at the link on our website.
And there's a blues festival. This is close to my heart, of course. A blues festival coming to the Big Island starting tomorrow afternoon.
It's right up your alley. The Big Island Blues Festival will feature artists including Ronnie V and the Family Band, Bottle of Blue, Tommy Isobe, and others, plus various vendors and barbecue food, of course, that goes with blues. This is for the whole family. It's from 2 to 10 p.m. at Hale Halawai State Park in Kailua Kona. For tickets, please go to the link on our website.
You know, barbecue and blues do go together really
That's
well.
That's what I hear, yeah.
Thanks a lot, Derek.
You're welcome.
Derek Malama joins the conversation to take a closer look at some events in our community that might be going on under the radar. You can always find out more on our website, hawaiipublicradio.org.
That's going to wrap it up for this week, but we promise we'll be back next week. Author and professor Ed Hess says humility is the new smart. We'll sit down with him, and we'll also talk with Trish LaChica of the Hawaii Pacific Health Institute to talk about Bill 70. That would prohibit smoking and vaping on Oahu in a motor vehicle where a minor is present.
And a fellow at the East-West Center says failure is the only possibility for our North Korea policy.
We like to hear from you. Sorry about that, Chris. We do like to hear from you. And you can call our talkback line and leave us your comments. Here's the number. It's 808-792-8217 or email us at talkback@hawaiipublicradio.org. You can post comments on Facebook at The Conversation or tweet us at HI Conversation or tweet me at BKOZHPR.
If you missed any of The Conversation or any other show we air, you can find them all on the new HPR app. Search for HPR in the Apple App Store or on Google Play. Our executive producer of The Conversation is Beth Ann Kozlovich.
Lillian Song produces the program. Ryan Finnerty and Amber Khan are our production assistants.
And the Backyard Quiz theme was written for us by John DeMello. I'm Chris Vanderkoop.
I'm Beth Ann Kozlovich. We'll be back with you on Monday when we all sit down to pick up The Conversation.